Good evening, dear audience. Have you ever tried to speak underwater? I'm sure you have, and I'm sure you know that it's not easy. Our ears have evolved for air, but so has radio. So what am I doing here? What is he doing here? Get out. We want to listen to the performances, and so do I. But bear with me, please, for some minutes, because I want to explore how radio and sound have actually been very important in transforming maritime spaces and are still very important in transforming them. So you know that oceans cover more or less 75% of the surface of the Earth, but you also know that we know very little about them. The question is, how do we know what we know? Which is the same as asking, how do we find things down there in the oceans, and how do we find our ways in the oceans? Imagine you are a captain of a submarine. Imagine you're Captain Nemo, for instance. So the way Captain Nemo knows where he is basically by opening the curtains and looking through the window. That, unfortunately, is not going to work. Real submarine captains, decades after Jules Verne wrote his novel, when they went down in the water, they realized it was dark down there, and there were no points of reference. So how did they find their ways underwater? They used the sun, they used the stars, like every other navigation, and they used the compass. This required them to go up in the surface and then attack submerged. This was roughly the situation in World War I. World War II had both bad news and good news for submarine captains. The good news, let's start with the good news, they had to do with radio. In World War II, radio was used for communicating submarines with one another and also submarines with land to organize these famous Wolf Pack attacks. The problem was that very early on into the war, the Allies were able to locate the source of the transmission and therefore kill a lot of submarines. So if you're a submarine captain, you stop using that technique. And in World War II, the other technique that was used was triangulating your position, receiving signals sent by radio stations at land. And let me see if this works. Yes. One of the systems was the so-called LOFAR, but this is the SONE German system. And as I said, what it does is emit pulses from different points in land, and when a submarine captain gets two of them, they can know where their coordinates. So this is called radio navigation, and maps like this one have been transforming the oceanic space and the geopolitics of the oceans in World War II onwards. The bad news for submarine captains in World War II also came from radio, and in particular, radio detection and ranging systems, radar, so these electromagnetic waves that allow people to find objects when the waves bounce back. If the object that you find is a submarine, you can kill it. If you're a submarine captain, what do? You go underwater. So here we are again, underwater. How do we find our way underwater? So radio doesn't work underwater. We know that. But sound works very well underwater. Water is a very good sound transmitter. So what people did was employ different ways of taking advantage of that situation. If you are able to turn a microphone into a hydrophone, so if you're able to develop an underwater microphone, then you will be receiving lots and lots of sounds down there and being able to interpret them. This is what hydrophones did, filtering sounds, making them audible, looking for frequencies, looking for directions. There were a myriad sounds down there. So this could be very useful, but also very confusing. Let's try to listen to the first sound, please. So you see, it has the cadence of an engine. Maybe what if you're worried, looking for enemies, what do you think this is? Any volunteer? It's an animal. Did you know that before? Yeah. So he would have survived. Some other people maybe in the room would have been dead by now, or maybe not. Animals don't kill, but, well, not don't kill submarines. So yes, it's a whale. It's an echolocating whale. It's using sonar. There were many other sounds like this one, so many that in World War II, one of the problems of different navies around the world was to decide what was what. There were acousmatic sounds, let's say. And Alex Hui, who has participated earlier today, and I have worked a little bit on this issue, and we found different tests in 1942 onwards, performed by different navies, including one by the US Navy, in which they teach sonar operators how to develop a new underwater ear, how to listen to new sounds previously unheard of, and how to locate them and identify them. So we are going to run a little test tonight. I'm going to need your help, and I'm going to need your imagination. If you know all the answers, the gentleman here in the first row, please don't tell. But I'm sure you're going to be lost with the first one. Can we please play those sounds?
Series D16. The most important part of your job as operators of the expendable radiosonic buoy equipment is that you be able to recognize and interpret the sounds made by submarines maneuvering underwater. There is only one way for you to develop this ability, that is, to listen to such sounds and study them many, many times. This series of phonograph records has been prepared for just that purpose. Play them over and over until you become completely familiar with those particular sounds which mean a submarine. Water, you will recall, is a very good conductor of sound. As a result, it is never completely quiet underwater.
Sorry about that, but it says, I don't know if you could hear it, that it's never quite, quiet underwater, and that in order to recognize these sounds, you need to play them over and over. So I'm sorry we didn't have time to play them over and over, but we are going to try to recognize them. So it's six sounds, and we are going to see which is which. Please, the first sound. Any volunteer? What's that? Ice flow, wow, this audience is amazing. Okay, well done. Second sound, please. This is perhaps easier. No, not a submarine. Cargo ship, yeah. Well done. The next one, I think it's difficult, but let's see. Please, next one. Snapping shrimp. Wow. Yes, so this is a bunch of shrimps doing this with their fingers, basically, which taking one by one is not too loud, but if you take a whole school, it can basically hide a submarine that you're looking for. So the next sound, although we already know this one, so if you can play it, yeah. This was, as you recall, the first one, so the sperm whale. Okay, next sound, please. The croaker fish. Yeah, I should have named the thing in German, but I think it's Adlerfisch, which is pretty amazing, the sound it makes. Okay, and now the last sound, please. This is finally the only one left. This is finally our submarine. So if you are a sonar operator, listen for enemy submarines. This is good to know which is which, right? But this is for communication and for reception. This doesn't quite solve the problem of finding your way underwater. For that, you need transmission. For that, you need sonar. And I'm sure you've all heard active sonar in the movies. But let's imagine you're, again, a sonar operator, and you're emitting a ping, and you're waiting for it to bounce on objects to know where they are coming from, and so on. So in that mind frame, can we please play the sonar? Okay, so there were two responses. That probably means that there are two objects. One of them is closer than the other. That's why time delay tells you about distance. So if you hear that one is farther away than the other, then you try to run the other way, I suppose. So sonar, together with radio navigation, has transformed the oceans in several ways. For the animals already living there, it has produced noise, and it has produced competition for frequency bands. For humans, it has given us access to the deep ocean. It has increased our knowledge of the volume of the ocean, and it has also changed the politics. It has given new possibilities for politics. In particular, when you can, by radio navigation, mark exact point in the ocean, and by sonar know its depth, then you can produce the first maps of the ocean floor. Oh, this is sonar, sorry. First maps of the ocean floor, like this one. And if you think about it, what this map of the ocean floor is doing is removing the water and depicting the floor of the ocean as terra, as territory. This gives you the possibility of territorializing the seas. And for the last half of the 20th century, the seas have become sovereign territory. The sovereign territory has gone from 3 miles to 200 nautical miles. And because this kind of map also allows you to claim where your continental shelf ends and where it begins. It allows you to drill for oil, for instance, and you need to secure the territory in order to do that, and so many other things. But sonar and sound have not only given us information about the bottom of the ocean, it has also given us information about what is between the surface and the bottom. It has turned the oceans from surfaces for transportation into volumes full of life and currents and ecosystems. So this is the Mediterranean, same as this one, but this depicts the ocean, but it depicts it not as we see it when we sail in a ship, but as an entire ecosystem with interconnected currents and ecologies of life. So basically, through sound, you can, because sound waves get scattered and their trajectories get deviated by different temperatures, by different currents, even by a school of fish, by plankton migrating day and night, you can learn a lot about the volume of the oceans. And that's a tool that people, scientists, have developed in the last 70 years, more or less. So these two imaginations of the Mediterranean, for instance, as territory and as ecosystems, I think they are visible in the policies, in the conflicting policies that the EU, for instance, has today, nowadays, on the Mediterranean. On the one hand, the EU sees the Mediterranean as territory and as a place in which you can draw a line, draw a border between the north and the south, and the way you do that is technologically. You cannot put barbed wire in the ocean. You use radio, you use GPS, you use a bunch of different things that I'll talk a little bit about. For the other imagination of the ocean, this one, The marine ecosystem of the Mediterranean is fragile, is threatened by pollution, by global warming, and the goal is to preserve it. For that, you need to think about it as a whole, as an ecosystem, not as divided between north and south, but as integrated. Those two views of the European Union are conflicting, but they depend on the same network of sensors that are placed well above the sea in radars that are measuring level of the seas, that are through electromagnetic waves, they are detecting oil spills, they are detecting ships as they move, even with migrants. There are also sensors not well above in the air, but anchored to the bottom of the oceans, like pressure sensors. But there are also sensors drifting away with the currents of the Mediterranean, like this AgroMet, which are a bunch of self-buoyant sonobuoys, so buoys that are deep underwater and that they emit sonic pulses, and then they come back to surface and they send the data through radio to central stations. So we can see how radio and sound are part of larger ecosystems of infrastructures and sensors that transform the way we interact with the oceanic environment. Is it up to us to decide whether these ecosystems, big technological systems, where do they go, basically? It's up to us to find ways for them to help us create a socially and environmentally sustainable oceanic environment. Thank you very much.